Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. Episode 1. Adapted for radio and performed by Jeremy Nicholas.
What an interesting case I must be from a medical point of view. With me, it's my liver that's out of order. I know it's my liver that's out of order because I've just been reading a patent liver pill circular in which are detailed various symptoms by which a man can tell when his liver is out of order. I have all the symptoms. The chief among them being a general disinclination to work of any kind. What I suffer in that way, no tongue can tell. From my earliest infancy, I've been a martyr to it. As a boy, the disease hardly ever left me for a day. They didn't know then it was my liver. The medical science was in a far less advanced state than now. They used to put it down to laziness. Why, you skulking little devil, you, they say, get up and do something for your living, can't you? Not knowing, of course, that I was ill. And they didn't give me pills. They gave me clumps on the side of the head. I remember we were sitting in my room smoking and talking about how bad we were. Bad from a medical point of view, I mean, of course. There were four of us. George and William Samuel Harris and myself and Montmorency. We sat there for half an hour describing to each other our maladies. And what we want is rest, said Harris. Rest and a complete change, said George. Let's go up the river. He said we should have fresh air, exercise and quiet. The constant change of scenery would occupy our mind, including what there was of Harris's. And the hard work would give us a good appetite and make us sleep well. Harris said he didn't think George ought to do anything that would have a tendency to make him sleepier than he always was, that it might be dangerous. He thought that if George did sleep any more, he might just as well be dead. And so save his board and lodging. Harris, however, said that the river would suit him to a T. I don't know what a T is, but it suited me to a T, too. And Harris and I both said it was a good idea of George's. The only one who was not struck with the suggestion was Montmorency. We were 3-1, however, and the motion was carried. We pulled out the maps and discussed plans. We arranged to start on the following Saturday from Kingston. Harris and I would go down in the morning and take the boat up to Chertsey, and George, who wouldn't be able to get away from the city till the afternoon, would meet us there. George goes to sleep in a bank from 10 to 4 each day. Except Saturdays when they wake him up and put him outside at 2. Should we camp out or sleep at inns? George and I were all for camping out. We said it would be so wild and free. We'd run our little boat into some quiet nook, and the tent is pitched, and the frugal supper cooked and eaten, the big pipes are filled and lighted, and the pleasant chat goes round. And lulled by the lapping water and the rustling trees, we fall asleep beneath the great still stars and dream that the world is young again. How about when it rains, said Harris? You can never rouse Harris. There's no poetry about Harris. No wild yearning for the unattainable. If Harris's eyes fill with tears, you can bet it's because Harris has been eating raw onions. However, his practical view of the matter came as a timely hint. Camping out in rainy weather is not pleasant. We therefore decided that we should sleep out on fine night and hotel it and inn it and pub it like respectable folk when it was wet or when we felt inclined for a change. Montmorency hailed this compromise with much approval. He does not revel in romantic solitude. To look at Montmorency, you would imagine that he was an angel sent upon the earth in the shape of a small fox terrier. His idea of life, however, is to collect a gang of the most disreputable dogs to be found in the town and lead them out to march round the slums to fight other disreputable dogs. And so he gave to the suggestion of inns and pubs and hotels his most emphatic approbation. On the following evening, we assembled again to discuss our plans. George said, "We won't have a tent," he said. "We'll have a boat with a cover. It's ever so much simpler, and it converts the boat into a sort of little house." It is beautifully cosy. They're a trifle stuffy, but everything has its drawbacks. As the man said when his mother-in-law died and they asked him for the funeral expenses. Now, for clothes, George said that two suits of flannel would be sufficient, as we could wash them ourselves in the river when they got dirty. Well, then we discussed the food question. George said, "Begin with breakfast." George is so practical. Now, for breakfast, we shall want a frying pan. Harris said it was indigestible. A teapot, a kettle, and a methylated spirit stove. Now, for other breakfast things, George suggested eggs and bacon, which were easy to cook, cold meat, tea, bread and butter, and jam. For lunch, he said we could have biscuits, cold meat, bread and butter, and jam. For drink, we took some wonderful sticky concoction of Harris's, which you mix with water and called lemonade, and plenty of tea, and a bottle of whiskey, in case, as George said, we got upset. It seemed to me that George harped too much on the getting upset idea. It seemed to me to be the wrong spirit to go about the trip in. I'm glad we took the whiskey. Harris and I and Montmorency got to Waterloo at 11 on the Saturday morning and asked where the 11.5 to Kingston started from. Of course, nobody knew. Nobody at Waterloo ever does know where a train is going to start from, or where a train, when it does start, is going to, or anything about it. The porter who took our things thought it would go from number 2 platform, while another porter had heard a rumour that it would go from number 1. The station master, on the other hand, was convinced it would start from the local. To put an end to the matter, we went upstairs and asked the traffic superintendent, and he told us that he just met a man who said he'd seen it. At number 3 platform. We went to number 3 platform, but the authorities there said that they rather thought that train was the Southampton Express, or else the Windsor Loop. But they were sure it wasn't the Kingston train. Though why they were sure it wasn't, they couldn't say. Then our porter said he thought it must be it on the high-level platform. Said he thought he knew the train. So we went to the high-level platform and saw the engine driver and asked him if he was going to Kingston. He said he couldn't say for certain, of course, but that he rather thought he was. Anyhow, if he wasn't the 11.5 for Kingston, he said he was pretty confident he was the 9.32 for Virginia Water, or the 10 a.m. express for the Isle of Wight, or somewhere in that direction, and we should all know when we got there. We slipped half a crown into his hand and begged him to be the 11.5 for Kingston. Nobody will ever know on this line what you are or where you're going. You know the way. You slip off quietly and go to Kingston.
Well, I don't know, gents. I suppose some train's got to go to Kingston.
I'll do it. Give me the half crown.
And thus we got to Kingston by the London and South Western Railway.
We learnt afterwards that the train we had come by was really the Exeter Mail. They spent hours at Waterloo looking for it.
Nobody knew what had become of it.
Our boat was waiting for us at Kingston, just below the bridge, and to it we wended our way, and round it we stored our luggage, and into it we stepped.
"You're all right, sir?"
said the man. "Right it is," we answered, and with Harris at the sculls and I at the tiller lines and Montmorency unhappy and deeply suspicious in the prow, out we shot onto the waters, which for a fortnight were to be our home. It was a glorious morning, late spring or early summer, as you care to take it. The quaint back streets of Kingston, where they came down to the water's edge, looked quite picturesque in the flashing sunlight. The glinting river with its drifting barges, the wooded towpath, the trim-kept villas on the other side, Harris in a red and orange blazer, grunting away at the sculls. I mused on Kingston, or Kinningaston, as it was once called, in the days when Saxon kingies were crowned there. Great Caesar crossed the river there, and the Roman legions camped upon its sloping uplands. Caesar, like Elizabeth I in later years, seems to have stopped everywhere. Only he was more respectable than Elizabeth. He didn't put up at the public houses. She was nuts on public houses, was England's virgin queen. There's scarcely a pub of any attractions within 10 miles of London that she doesn't seem to have looked in at, or stopped at, or slept at some time or other. I wonder now, supposing Harris, say, turned over a new leaf and became a great and good man and got to be Prime Minister and died. If they put up signs over the public houses that he had patronised, Harris had a glass of bitter in this house. Harris had 2 of Scotch here in the summer of 88. Harris was chucked from here in December 1886. Be too many of them. It'd be the houses that he never entered that would become famous. The only house in South London Harris never had a drink in. The people would flock to it to see what could have been the matter with it. At this point, Harris threw away the skulls, got up and left his seat, sat on his back, and proposed that I should take a turn. So I got out and took the tow line and ran the boat on past Hampton Court. Harris asked me if I'd ever been in the maze at Hampton Court. He said he went in once to show somebody else the way. He had studied it up on the map, and it was so simple that it seemed foolish. Hardly worth the tuppence charge for admission. Harry said he thought the map must have been got up as a practical joke because it wasn't a bit like the real thing and only misleading. It was the country cousin that Harris took in. He said, "Oh, we'll just go in here so that you can say you've been, but it's very simple. It's absurd to call it a maze. You keep on taking the first turning right. Well, we'll just walk around for 10 minutes and then and go and get some lunch." They met some people soon after they got inside who said they'd been there for 3/4 of an hour and had had about enough of it. Harris told them that they could follow him if they liked. He was just going in and then should turn around and come out again. They said it was very kind of him and fell behind and followed. They picked up various other people who wanted to get it over as they went along until they absorbed all the persons in the maze. People who had given up all hopes of ever getting either in or out or of ever seeing their home and friends again plucked up courage at the sight of Harris and his party and joined the procession blessing him. Harris said he should judge there must have been 20 people following him in all, and one woman with a baby who had been there all the morning insisted on taking his arm for fear of losing him. Harris kept on turning to the right, but it seemed a long way, and his cousin said he supposed it was a very big maze. "Oh, it's one of the largest in Europe," said Harris. "Yes, it must be," replied the cousin. because we walked a good 2 miles already. Harris began to think it rather strange himself. He produced his map.
Well, that map may be all right, said one of the party. If you know whereabouts in it, we are now.
Harris didn't know, and suggested that the best thing to do would be to go back to the entrance and begin again. For the beginning again part of it, there was not much enthusiasm. But with regard to the advisability of going back to the entrance, there was complete unanimity. And so they turned and trailed after Harris again in the opposite direction. About 10 minutes more passed, and then they found themselves in the centre. Harris thought at first of pretending that that was what he'd been aiming at. But the crowd looked dangerous, and he decided to treat it as an accident. Anyhow, they got something to start from then. They did know where they were, and the map was once more consulted, and the thing seemed simpler than ever, and off they started. And 3 minutes later, they were back in the centre again. After that, they simply couldn't get anywhere else. Whatever way they turned brought them back to the middle. It became so regular at length that some of the people stopped there and waited for the others to take a walk round it and come back to them. Harris drew out his map again after a while, but the sight of it only infuriated the mob, and they told him to go and curl his hair with it. Harris said that he couldn't help feeling that, to a certain extent, he had become unpopular. They all got crazy at last and sang out for the keeper, and the man came and climbed up the ladder outside and shouted out directions to them. But all their heads were by this time in such a confused whirl that they were incapable of grasping anything. And so the man told them to stop where they were, and he would come to them. And they huddled together and waited, and he climbed down and came in. He was a young keeper, as luck would have it, and new to the business. And when he got in, he couldn't get to them. And then he got lost. They caught sight of him every now and then, rushing about the other side of the hedge, and he would see them and rush to get to them, and they would wait there for about 5 minutes, and then he would reappear again in exactly the same spot and ask them where they'd been. They had to wait until one of the old keepers came back from his dinner before they got out. Harry said he thought it was a very fine maze, so far as he was a judge, and we agreed that we would try to get George to go into it on our way back. It took us some time to pass through Molesey Lock, as we were the only boat, and it's a big lock. I stood and watched Molesey Lock sometimes when you couldn't see any water at all, but only a brilliant tangle of bright blazers and many-coloured parasols and streaming ribbons and dainty whites. You might fancy it was a huge box into which flowers of every hue and shade had been thrown pell-mell and lay piled up in a rainbow heap that covered every corner. The river affords a good opportunity for dress, and for once in a way, we men are able to show our taste in colours, and I think we come out very natty, if you ask me. I always like a little red in my things, red and black, and I always think a light blue necktie goes so well with it. Harris always keeps to shades or mixtures of orange or yellow. I don't think he's at all wise in this. His complexion's too dark for yellows. Yellows don't suit him. There can be no question about it. George had bought some new things for this trip, and I was rather vexed about them. The blazer is loud. We asked him what colour he called it. He said he didn't know. He said he didn't think there was a name for the colour. The man had told him it was an oriental design. George put it on and asked us what we thought of it. Harry said that, as an object to hang over a flower bed to frighten the birds away, he should respect it, but that considered as an article of dress for a human being, it made him ill. Thank you. We stopped under the willows by Kempton Park and lunched. It's a pretty little spot there, a pleasant grass plateau running along by the water's edge. We had just commenced the third course, the bread and jam, when a gentleman in shirt sleeves and a short pipe came along and wanted to know if we knew that we were trespassing. We said we hadn't given the matter sufficient consideration as yet to enable us to arrive at a definite conclusion on that point, but that if he assured us on his word as a gentleman that we were trespassing, we would, without further hesitation, believe it. He gave us the required assurance, and we thanked him. But he still hung about and seemed to be dissatisfied, so we asked him if there was anything further we could do for him. And Harris, who is of a chummy disposition, offered him a bit of bread and jam. I fancy he must have belonged to some society sworn to abstain from bread and jam, for he declined it quite gruffly, as if he were vexed at being tempted with it. And he added that it was his duty to turn us off. Harris said that if it was a duty, it ought to be done. And asked the man what was his idea with regard to the best means for accomplishing it. Harris is what you would call a well-made man of about number one size and looks hard and bony. And the man measured him up and down and said he would go and consult his master and then come back and chuck us both into the river. Of course, we never saw him anymore. And of course, all he really wanted was a shilling. There are a certain number of riverside roughs who make quite an income during the summer by slouching about the banks and blackmailing weak-minded noodles in this way. They represent themselves as sent by the proprietor. Now, where they really are sent by the owners, those owners ought to be shown up. The selfishness of the riparian proprietor grows with every year. If these men had their way, they would close down the River Thames altogether. They actually do this in some places by driving posts into the bed of the stream and nailing huge notice boards on every tree. The sight of those notice boards rouses every evil instinct in my nature. I feel I want to tear each one down and hammer it over the head of the man who put it up until I've killed him. And then I would bury him and put the board up over the grave as a tombstone. I mentioned these feelings of mine to Harris, and he said he had them worse than that. He said he not only felt he wanted to kill the man who caused the board to be put up, but that he should like to slaughter the whole of his family and all his friends and relations and then burn down his house. This seemed to me to be going too far, and I said so to Harris, but he answered, "Not a bit of it. Serve them all jolly well right, and I go and sing comic songs on the ruins." It's one of Harris's fixed ideas that he can sing a comic song. The fixed idea, on the contrary, among those of Harris's friends who have heard him try, is that he can't, and never will be able to, and ought not to be allowed to try. You don't... I'll just give you an idea of Harris's comic singing, and then you can judge for yourself. Harris, standing in front of a piano and addressing the expectant mob.
Well, it's a very old thing, you know, but it's the only thing I know. It's the judge's song, Out of Pinafore. Oh, no, I don't mean pinafore. I mean the other thing, you know. You must all join in the chorus, you know.
Murmurs of delight and anxiety to join in the chorus. Brilliant performance of the prelude to the judge's song in Trial by Jury by Nervous Pianist. Moment arrives for Harris to join in. Harris takes no notice of it. Nervous Pianist commences judge's song in Trial by Jury again, and Harris dashes off the first two lines of the Admiral's song Out of Pinafore. Nervous Pianist: I'm afraid there's a mistake somewhere. What are you singing?
Well, the judge's song, out of Trial by Jury, don't you know it?
No, you're not, you chucklehead,
says a friend of Harris's from the back of the room. You're singing the Admiral's song from Pinafore. Long argument between Harris and Harris's friend as to what Harris is really singing. Pianist thereupon starts the prelude to the Admiral's song, and Harris, seizing what he considers to be a favourable opening in the music, begins.
When I was young and called to you.
General roar of laughter, taken by Harris as a compliment.
When I was young, I served a term as office boy to an attorney.
It's too low. It's too low, old man. We'll have that again, if you don't mind. Cool.
When I was young, I served a term as office boy to an attorney.
Nervous old lady near the fire begins to cry and has to be led out.
I swept the windows and I swept the door and I...
No, I
cleaned the windows of the big front door and I polished up the floor.
No, dash it. Beg your pardon. Funny thing, I can't think of that line. And I... We'll get on to the chorus and chant it. And I diddle 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 till I am the ruler of the Queen's Navy. Well, you don't look for much of a voice in a comic song, but you do expect the words. And Harris never sees what an ass he's making of himself and how he's annoying a lot of people who never did him any harm.
That episode of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome was adapted for radio and performed by Jeremy Nicholas. Incidental music was composed by Jeremy Nicholas and played by the Grimethorpe Colliery Band. Three Men in a Boat was produced by Paul Mayhew Archer.